Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Elgin Talks. I'm your host, Mark Chappell, and for this episode, I was delighted to be joined by Richard Romer-Lee, Managing Director of the research consultancy business Square Mile, as well as our very own James Crossley, Head of UK Retail Distribution. Richard and Square Mile are, of course, well known across the industry, so I wanted to explore what are the most pressing concerns that he's hearing from advisors and discretionary managers, and also ask him about the expectations those investors have of target absolute return funds, which look to reduce volatility and still deliver performance in difficult markets. And I think we came to a really strong conclusion that communication and transparency are both crucial to managing investors' risk and return expectations. Two really quick points before we dive in. We recorded this episode at the beautiful London Stock Exchange, where Richard had just hosted a panel webinar with fund selectors and investment directors on diversification and the role of alternatives. Both he and James make a few mentions of this in our conversation, so if you're interested in watching more of that discussion, I've added a link in the episode description. Final point is that all three of us were in a brand new studio, so the audio quality is a little off from our usual levels. But enough from me, let's hear from Richard and James. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you very much. And my second guest is Elgin's own Head of UK Retail Sales, James Crossley. James, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. So we've just recorded a webinar, a fascinating panel webinar with the likes of Peter Griffin, Philip Bagshaw, John Rowe, on why diversification matters. So, Richard, I'd like to turn to you. What are the biggest concerns that you're hearing from clients, from investors about the world right now?
So two things spring to mind. The first, which came out loud and clear with the webinar that we've just done, which was the concern about the impact that trade wars might have on markets. Donald Trump, quite a forceful figure. China, a great unknown, and quite a lot of aggression between the two countries. What does that mean for trade? What does it mean for companies? What does it mean for the political status quo around the world? Actually, listening to the experts, it's a risk, mm-hmm. but people think that people don't think it's going to be a disaster.
Okay.
And thinking that Trump has got very much his eye ahead to 2020 and the prospects of being re-elected. So, alongside other political situations, Brexit, for example, these are unknowns. The impacts are unknowns in terms of the effect they might have on people's portfolios. And so that's the most important one.
I guess when we think about these kind of big macro risks like Trump, like Brexit, like the trade war, and then we also think about perhaps more traditional financial risks of what might trigger the next recession, the next economic downturn, I see those as isolated risks. Do your clients see them as one and separate that you need to keep an eye on? Or do they all form part and parcel of perhaps late cycle concerns?
So risks lurk around every corner, yeah. And there are many risks. And in the investment management world, many people think they're aware of what they are. But typically it's the risks that people are not focusing on or hadn't thought about that come and trip people up. It's important that not everybody knows everything. So the importance of diversification in portfolios, and particularly late cycle, mm-hmm. you know, where people are more cautious on the one hand about the levels of valuations and more nervous on the other hand. So if there is any shock, people are more likely to head for the door and quickly, and that can be devastating in terms of asset values.
I'd love to dive into that a bit deeper. You mentioned people are more cautious. Is that something you're seeing that's coming through the research from fund managers, from your clients as well? Where are you seeing this kind of cautiousness come through in the market, bottom up, top down?
It's a combination of both. First is where we are in the cycle, mainly because this economic cycle is in its 11th year now.
Yeah, it's a very long time.
But it's important to remember the last recession was brutal. Mm. And it was after years of excess, and the impact of that was absolutely enormous.
I imagine it looms large in people's memories even now.
It does. It's interesting how short people's memories are, so people start to forget about it, but it is what they anchor to. And there's a half a generation or a generation of investors who've not experienced a recession. They've not experienced inflation. They've not experienced aggressive interest rate rises, and they've not experienced tremendous asset price falls and panic.
I guess on paper that looks very different to actually in practice living through it.
Well, it does, but the likelihood is, first of all, when does the next one happen? Well, nobody knows. Will it be as great as the last one? Probably not, right? Hopefully those only come around once a century, mm-hmm. maybe twice. So people are cautious because it's a bit unknown.
Yep.
People don't really know what's going on. Secondly, their courses, because asset returns have been pretty good over recent years, yeah. and one has to guard against the complacency that might you know, if you've had double digit compound returns over an asset class or even high single digits in equities or what have you over recent years, people come to expect that, and that complacency can lead to disaster. So we see lots of people cautious, about the many risks and the unknown impact of some of the risks that people can identify.
If they're being quite cautious, they're looking to avoid these market risks. But as you say, these investors have become accustomed to these double digit returns in some of these asset classes, which could potentially lead to yield chasing of some description or return chasing. James, I'd love to turn this over to you. From clients, how are you hearing these people who want to avoid the market risks and avoid potentially the next downturn, and yet they still want those returns, they still want to beat inflation, they still want to hit those performance objectives that they've got for their clients?
Yes, certainly. So when we speak to our intermediary clients that we service, they are, as we've just explored, generally fully invested, mm-hmm. but they're mindful of this potential future volatility and the geopolitical risk that Richard's just highlighted. So they are seeking some element of protection mm-hmm. From this market risk, but they also want to ensure that they are capturing some of the late cycle upturn. And I think that came through in the webcast, is yeah. you can't fully be held in cash and expect to get a beta return. So I think what this has done, if I look at sort of product sets for what people are demanding from IFAs and wealth managers up and down the country, is it has garnered a renewed interest in sectors such as the absolute return sector, mm-hmm. a targeted absolute return. And I appreciate that's a very broad sector, but people are now refocusing their efforts on alternative structures in funds mm-hmm. in order to capture some of the upside, but actually limit some of the downside, which is a difficult skill.
Absolutely. Richard, anything to add on where investors' expectations and perhaps the mismatch of expectations in that place?
Well, what is so important is for investors and their representatives to understand where investors are trying to get to, the outcome yeah. that they're seeking through their savings. And not to lose sight of that, because one can, and therefore think about the long-term strategy, the long-term strategic asset allocation, and the assumptions for returns baked into that. Okay, because if we have been getting long double-digit returns in the shorter term from equities, mm-hmm. that's not what we expect longer term. It's not yeah. what's in the capital market assumptions. And so it's try to get away from the short-term experience and the exuberance of doing really well, and remember mm-hmm. what you're expecting in the longer term. So, for example, with some of our clients, and we know that the advisors have been doing this with these clients, more conservative investors have made 30-40% gains over the last mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years. They're 30-40% wealthier. They have a choice. They can take risk off the table yeah. in their portfolios because they've got that security that's built into their lifestyle. They may choose not to, but at least they're aware of it. So it's really important not to lose perspective of where you're trying to get to, where we are, and think more longer term about the outcomes that investors are expecting.
I think that takes us into, James, you just mentioned the target return sector, and one of the main targets of the target return sector is to lessen that volatility that we've seen come back in small part over the last year or so. How have, a question for you both, how have investors' attitudes towards volatility and the funds that aim to reduce volatility changed in that time?
I'll talk from a kind of distribution perspective and let Richard sort of pick it up from a market perspective. There's no doubt about it that people are looking for more choice. Mm. You know, it's simple equations going back. People bought equity funds, bond funds, and maybe some alternative asset classes, but there's definitely more choice out there. What we have seen undoubtedly is some disappointment with some of these new style funds, these absolute return funds.
It was definitely an unloved sector for a very
absolutely.
For a while.
You've seen that with the IA sectors, but I think it's important to note that within that sector there is choice, there is breadth. Mm-hmm. I think Richard said it eloquently in the webcast a moment ago, that this is a collection of funds. It's more of a genre than a sector.
That's a very nice way of putting it.
I'm good to plagiarise there. But you know, essentially, there's different styles of funds, and there's different choices. And you know, a phrase that I heard coined in the market as well is, when you're looking at absolute return sector in particular, is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. Because yes, there's been some large funds that are disappointed, but actually within there are some very credible funds that have managed not only to protect on the downside, which is one of the, you know, main raison d'etre for the funds, but actually participate in some of the upside. Mm. And I think, you know, I'm coming up with lots of phrases here today, but just to go over another one that was covered in the webcast by John Rowe, it was reckless proof. prudence. And Richard can elaborate on that, but it's actually some of these funds haven't taken enough risk at the right time, and that's what's actually hurt them more than the downside.
What do you feel investors mean by this phrase?
Well, it's really interesting. So first of all, volatility is a measure of risk. It's not the measure of risk. It's not a panacea to everything. And it's important to understand that volatility in itself, so that how much asset class prices have moved, is volatile in its own right. We are in a long period where volatility has been dampened. Yeah, we've had fairly benign market conditions, fairly benign economic conditions, fairly benign or supportive monetary conditions, which has led to relatively low volatility in asset classes over the longer term. Investors don't understand volatility, they don't spend volatility. It's the sensitivity, if you like, to the journey they're experiencing. Drawdown, perhaps, or permanent loss of capital are more relevant measures of risk, I think. That would be the first thing. The second thing is, so risk and return are two sides of the same coin when you're thinking about building an investment portfolio. So if you're seeking a return, you must take some risk. If you're seeking a greater return, you're likely to have to take greater risk. And our role collectively is to help investors understand that, so that, again, they can think about the outcomes they're expecting. And in terms of the reckless prudence, it's people thinking they can continue to get high returns with a low level of risk. Actually, what they should be doing with time on their side is taking more risk now when they're less susceptible to it, because risk is their friend. Right? Or volatility is their friend, rather, because actually with time that will deliver a greater return. And that means when the time comes that you don't want risk with your investment portfolio, you don't have to take it. Right? So it's really important to remember that. Absolute return is really interesting. And as James says, there are a myriad of approaches. But the principle is sort of investment nirvana, isn't it? I want a return, but I don't want to lose money. And in English, that sounds really attractive. In practice, like all investment, it's quite hard to do. There is a trade-off between return and risk, and again, how much return and how much risk you can take. In the UCITS world, it's only been possible for people to construct such outcomes since, I think, 2003.
It's quite recent.
So we had a big bull market, we had a big bust, and now we've had a big bull market. It's not surprising people are still, investment professionals are still feeling their way into how do they deliver that outcome for investors in one or a myriad of asset classes. It's not easy.
Not easy at all. And so given these difficult decisions for investors, what is it that they look for from the ideal absolute return fund? The promise of returns and lower volatility, lower drawdowns, of course, is very appealing. But what is it about a particular fund? Is it its track record? Is it a well-articulated investment strategy that really appeals to investors in this difficult sector?
I think it's hard. Investors look for different things, but ultimately, they're looking for a real return, right? And with a materially lower risk profile of the fund, measured in they don't want to lose money. Now, what we've seen in the market conditions we've had, we've seen some funds have developed quite a good track record, and then the market conditions or where they generate returns from changes, or perhaps they just have a bad time. And so what we're seeing is it's quite hard to deliver that return consistently. Mm-hmm. It's really important that the expectations in the fund objectives are conveyed very clearly so that investors have a reasonable expectation. And those should be against tangible objectives, not against the peer group, because the peer group is a mass of different approaches.
And that comes back to what you were saying, James, about the peer group being this breadth of so many different funds trying to achieve so many different targets that it's very difficult to compare apples with apples.
No, it is, and there are some data providers that will provide you with subcategories to make this easier, but yes, it's almost a nonsense to look at quartile rankings in this sector. You've got to go back to this sector, I think. I think people need to reappraise it, and people need to look at what's right for their clients. But as I say, certainly don't dismiss the sector, because there have been some larger casualties within. I think it has a lot of breadth. I think it is perhaps more future-proof than some sectors. Mm-hmm. So revisit the sector would be my advice.
One other thing I would say, and the reason why people have been attracted to the sector, is traditional safer havens are perceived to be risky. So let's think about cash. A lot of the country's savings is allocated to cash, where you're guaranteed a real loss at the moment, Right? So there's a desperation to what's the next step up where I don't have to take a huge equity type risk to get some return. And we've heard already today about the perceived value or lack of value in certain parts of the fixed income market, and particularly in government bonds, where typically there's lower risk or capital risk associated with that. That's not the case at the moment. So there's this desperate drive to seek returns, but not to go all into equities.
I'd like to turn this over to perhaps a rather potentially contentious question. But would you say these conditions of a long-running equity bull market, the difficult conditions for fixed income, as highlighted in the webinar, that these play into the larger trend of the move towards more index or index tracking products? And or are they more beneficial to active managers who can really demonstrate the benefits of active research? James?
I'll go first. And look, part of our diversity drive at LGIM is to get people to talk about all sorts of investments and not pigeonhole groups into one genre. And so my answer is quite simple. Both have a place.
Yep.
I'll obviously let Richard answer this more independently. But you know, there are teams of managers that can beat the market, and they've proven they can do that in the active world. But there is equally a place for index returns as well. So I don't like the argument that says one or t'other or versus. I think for me, it's active selectively and passive for portfolios moving forward.
So at the risk of not being contentious, I agree with James there. And if you go back to thinking about why people invest and how they construct their portfolios, generally there are three masters. There are three objectives they're trying to achieve. One is an outcome or a return. Either now or in the future, be it capital growth, be it delivering income, being a preservation of capital. The second is to manage the journey, if you like, or the risk, because as humans, people are susceptible to risks on a journey somewhere, and you want to make sure that they are able to tolerate that and they understand it. And the third, of course, is cost, right? And trying to deliver that outcome and that journey at a reasonable cost to investors. And so as James has already said, this isn't about active or passive. This isn't about exchange traded versus mutual. This isn't even about open-ended or closed-ended. They're all valid strategies that have a place to play in people's portfolios. And the right thing to do is to get the right measure of them. At Square Mile, we do use passive funds. That gives us certain market exposures. It helps us to get access to market exposures where perhaps you're at a stage of the cycle where it is more sensible to go into a passive fund, perhaps if there's lots of momentum in markets, for example. But here's contentious: the UK all company sector in the last 5 years, I think it's somewhere near 27% of that sector is now in passive funds.
27.
So there's a huge growth, and that's basically people saying we don't believe in the ability of some of the UK all companies funds. That's a substitution of active management to
that's
that.
That's a huge part of active management.
To that extent, okay, the UK all companies sector is a very broadly drawn sector, but typically the sort of quasi institutional, close to market, low ambition return portfolios have just been substituted by passive, where there's been a phenomenal price war. Yeah, so you can buy your passive exposure for a handful of basis points. We're starting to see a price war in active, and we're starting to see the reaction of active, much clearer objectives, taking more risk, higher active share to justify their existence, but also with the promise to deliver greater returns for investors. And who doesn't want greater returns?
James, your chance to be contentious, please do.
No, not contentious, I'm sorry, but just to take a middle ground that, you know, I think some people can polarise the debate with active and passive, I understand that, but, you know, there are products out there that actually combine the best of both, and without going through any kind of pitch on product, there are some fantastic multi-asset products out there from a range of providers that will take a very active view on asset allocation, both long-term strategic and short-term dynamic or tactical, but then what they will use predominantly underneath the bonnet after making those views of the world are passive instruments, where it would be a basket of ETFs or a basket of index funds, or indeed a blend of index and active. So I think there is a third way, and we mustn't, you know, polarize the debate. You can combine the skill of both to build successful solutions.
It's a way of expressing that view through these building blocks, as it were. You mentioned cost there, Richard, and I think this is a fascinating area that, and I'm sure it's one that you both hear so much about from your clients, is regulation and the drive that regulation has had for your clients, both from cost pressures, but also from other reporting methods as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you've seen regulation change the industry in the last few years?
Okay, so regulation is everywhere.
I mean, it's a broad area.
And with good reason. And the reason is this. The responsibility for savings in our country falls firmly at the feet of each and every one of us as individuals. And the risk associated with our savings not delivering the outcomes we want is borne pretty much entirely by individuals. Okay? And the regulation is all about having a competitive, professional financial services industry that is looking after those customers to ensure, so each and every one of us, to ensure that we are able to live our lives in the way that we want to, as far as possible. Okay, so, and the regulator observes that the industry doesn't bear or doesn't share that risk enough with investors. There's a social change that's already happened in our country. It's not often talked about. Most people, particularly in the private sector, don't have a normal retirement date now. I defy you to go into a room and ask people when they know that they're going to retire. You might have the odd person, probably in their 50s and 60s, probably worked for an insurance company for all their life. Great defined benefit scheme. Happy days. The rest of us, no chance. That change has already happened. Now, it's not all financial. It's not just because people can't afford it. Obviously, there's people want to stay working, they want to keep active and so on, but it's a big part of it. Right? And the regulation is there to make sure, first of all, that it's transparent what we're doing, so that then people can form their own judgments. And with that transparency, with that clarity, it enables efficient competition. I don't think the regulator is a price regulator. Far from it. The regulator wants transparency to enable people to make informed decisions and then use those informed decisions to generate a fully functioning competitive market that is doing well alongside its customers.
Yeah, I agree with everything Richard says there, and I suppose specifically for an asset manager at the moment, there's some very hard-working product development people across the industry that are taking on board the recommendations from the asset market management study, and as Richard said, greater transparency and governance are the end result from this. So whether it's looking at cost and charges, enhancements to benchmarks, changes in objectives, the recruitment of independent non-executive directors for boards, this is all to push for greater transparency and governance for clients. And whilst it's a lot of hard work for the industry, I don't think anyone can argue against it being a good thing.
Fascinating. And gentlemen, to begin to bring this conversation to a close, we've talked a lot about what the industry is talking about, and very, very vocally. What do you feel, what are the trends or the changes that you're seeing that the industry isn't talking about? What's going unnoticed that you think should be noticed a little bit more?
Yikes, the unknown unknowns. For us, a big trend is vertical integration, which is a part of people thinking about the sustainability of their business models. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the RDR came in at the end of 2012 and broadly changed the role of advisors or the business model from a transactional model where they were paid by the manufacturer to a service model where they're paid by the customer. So financial advisors, as the agent of the customers, right, and the customers themselves have the control, quite rightly, in terms of what the industry is doing. And we're seeing people evolve their business models to get closer to the client, to move away from product more to service, and to think about the value of what they do and how that supports their clients. That's an enormous change which is driving a lot of the corporate activity, a lot of the business models, and a lot of the behaviour in the industry. The second thing, I think, is about the industry exercising its role in society. That is about the stewards of capital, looking after people's long-term savings and making sure those people are okay. Allocating capital to those companies that they believe are sustainable, and that deserve it, and of course, being a big part of the economy and a great place to work, it's a super industry to work in. Not that people outside it believe that, and so the whole concept of sustainability, of governance, of looking after the environment is becoming, I think, embedded into everything that we do, quite rightly, because we should be exercising our responsibility to make sure that we're creating a better world for everybody to live in.
Oh, completely. James, would you agree, the move from product to service model, the industry stewardship, would you see these as as things that industry needs to be talking about more, or are there other elements?
Yeah, I think as Richard says, ESG is fundamental going forward, baked into every product, not just specific ESG products. And I think that we're on a journey. We're taking our financial advisors and wealth managers on a journey, listening to their leads, trying to develop product, trying to be more consultative in what we develop. But I think it is a nascent journey, and we just need to be aware there's much more to do. And I think if I was to identify a gap that I'm seeing, is I think a lot of our intermediary clients, that's what me and my team do, are aware of the need and are developing the need, but does the end consumer appreciate where their money is invested and how it's stewarded? So I think there's a lot of work to do for us as an industry to educate the end consumer, as well as work in partnership with our intermediary clients. So it's going to be an immense task, and I think we're starting it. We just perhaps need to drip that down from our professional clients down to the end user, and we'll be working hard to do that.
So I think the main kind of takeaway I've taken from both of you there is the importance of transparency and expectations for investors and both intermediaries and their clients, and the importance of communication and education around kind of what it is that they're invested in, how risk is measured, and what they can expect from their financial futures.
You know, I think we have to be careful. I mean, that we don't sound a bit haughty by saying we're going to educate our clients. You know, they allocate our money, or their money, or their agents to your firms, to our firms, to look after them. I think the important bit, as you've touched on there, is taking them on the journey with us, having the humility and the time to explain to them what we're doing on their behalf and what it might mean to them, not just talking generically at a high level in gobbledygook, which they won't understand. It's about taking them on that journey and explaining to them what we're doing for them and what options it should provide them with.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was a really fascinating conversation. Richard, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, James.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to hear more from LGM Talks, or if you'd like to listen to the fascinating webinar we've just recorded, we've linked to the webinar's recording in the episode show notes. And thank you again to our wonderful production team, to our wonderful guests, and see you again next week for more LGM Talks. Thank you and goodbye.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.